Shrink Wrap Radio number 744. Dr. Kristen Lee on creative ideas for getting through the pandemic.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today, Dr. Kristen Lee, is an internationally recognized award-winning behavioral science professor, clinician, author, and activist from Boston, Massachusetts. She was my guest in 2015 on number 457, A Proactive Approach to Stress, and again in 2017 on episode number 578, Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. Today's interview is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Kristen Lee, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back. You know, I say welcome back. You were my guest way back in 2015 on episode number 457, A Proactive Approach to Stress. And then a couple years later in 2017, number 578, Mintelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. And you were such an energetic and creative guest that for some time had been on my mind, I got to find an excuse to get her back on here. we got to come up with a topic or something. And so a topic that seemed really relevant is, you know, what's going on right now with the pandemic, and we're into it now for a year. Which is amazing, and a year that both seem, in some ways seems to maybe have taken a long time. I don't know how it is for you. To me, in some ways, the year has gone by really quickly. Mm. It's changed my sense of time somehow.
Mm. Yeah, I felt that as well, and heard a lot of people echo those same sentiments, that time feels like very distorted, and that simultaneous, like it seems like so long, and yet it's like a snap.
Yeah, that's been my experience. So I know one of the things you've been looking at is you've been doing some research on resilience, which is a very relevant topic for right now. So what are some of the takeaways from your looking into that literature?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I've just been delighted, you know, to be human resilience researcher through the years. You know, that interest really was initially piqued after years of being a psychotherapist. And, you know, just like you, as you think about your work legacy and in this show, even when we think about the power of our stories and the power of, you know, us as a species that are wired for resilience, it's quite a thing to behold. And I think the pandemic in particular has illuminated this whole phenomena that we can adapt even in incredibly adverse conditions. And, you know, we can, you know, be creative in how we reimagine all of our routines and kind of all the comfort we once knew. And, you know, we can work together to reimagine notions of success and, you know, really be able to look at what protects us in times of enormous distress and trauma. And so I think I feel grateful that this has been my life's work. And I think this past year I've seen just such a surge, such an increase in interest in how do we leverage what the best of the science shows us that can help protect us in times such as these that feel like unprecedented and like a test of a lifetime.
Yeah, really, I'll say, and attest individually as a species, as a planet, we're tested at a lot of different levels here.
Mm.
And but we do have this what do you call it, homeostatic kind of system built into our body, and also I think psychologically, our brains are wired to keep us on an even keel, and but certainly this is called upon all of that built-in capabilities that we have, and there have been remarkable examples of communities of people who've come together and created things and done things together and so on.
Yeah, I think sometimes I feel like it's this element of it's heartbreaking times and also heartening times all at the same time, right? And I think we have seen, again, this test really, it can bring out the best and the worst in us. And we see so many examples of how important our relationships are, how protective they are for our well-being. And, you know, to keep us resilient through such circumstances. And then, like you said, you know, just that element of being wired for plasticity, for adaptation, and for that return to our happiness set points, to our homeostasis, right? And again, that's not like, I think sometimes in pop psychology, which I know we share that aversion to these very watered down or oversimplified things, right?
Yes.
But when we look at the science of resilience and of human flourishing, it's very encouraging because it shows us that we can look at what is within our locus of control and then engage deliberately in, you know, mindsets, behaviors, activities, all the things that can nourish and protect us, even when it feels like, you know, it's going to be impossible to feel resilient, you know, during impossible times. And that's something that I think a lot of the work I've been doing, whether the writing or research or just the work I do with students in an academic environment and with companies, I've been, you know, before the pandemic, I was generally working usually on average like a company or organization per week. Now I'd say I'm doing on average 3 to 4 webinars a week. With corporations from around the world who just grappling with, you know, what do we do to build a resilient culture at work? How do we build safety or like a sense of psychological safety and trust in our environment? As we know, if we can create help-seeking and help-giving environments, whether in our families or communities or faith-based organizations or our work environments, when we create that sense that we can be ourselves and we can share the messy parts of our stories just as much as we can share the accomplished parts of our stories, that is very, very protective. And, you know, when we have environments with peer support, that can make a tremendous difference. So it's been interesting because I really feel, as I think about my clinical work through the years and now these windows into what people are grappling with, it really shows me again that we're moving in the right direction. I think there's less stigma with mental health, even though we have far to come still. But I see that willingness, like I think the pandemic has just turned us upside down, right? And I haven't really heard anyone say, oh, my mental health is great right now, or it's gotten better than before this, or, you know, like I think we're all grappling with a lot of variables, whether it's ourselves, our loved ones, so I think it has opened people up to be more brave to talk about what their lived experiences are. And I think that truly can become a catalyst for healing when we can be more of ourselves and create those kinds of ecosystems around us that can really make a difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've always been somebody who hopefully didn't overshare, but always kind of was willing to share my story as a way of building a bridge to another person. And you take a little bit of a risk when you do that, because often I would find that, you know, if I was at some kind of a group gathering, you know, where people are pairing up a little bit and just chatting while holding a cup of coffee or a cocktail or something like that, And unfortunately, it wasn't always reciprocated. Sometimes, you know, the person, but maybe it was more that environment really didn't invite it. But I think that Lady Gaga coming out and Oprah's interview with, you know, with a royal couple. Did you have any thoughts about that? I mean, that was certainly, the palace family and so on, that whole royal family has been getting a lot of exposure, not all positive, but it's sort of one of the things going on, I think, is bringing them down to human size.
Yeah.
I don't know if you followed any of that or not.
Absolutely. I think Meghan Markle's story and her courage to share it is really remarkable. And I think it really, and you mentioned Lady Gaga. And I see, you know, this happening overwhelmingly where people are making courageous choices to tell the truth, you know, and even to speak truth to power. And I think that's something we've seen really emerge in the pandemic, is that gone are the days where these systems of oppression and discrimination, whether racism, classism, heterosexism, ableism, ageism, we're seeing, you know, xenophobia, we're seeing now, I think, just a level of new accountability that is long overdue. Yeah. And when we think about like the mental health world, or, you know, you mentioned like the notion of the overshare, right? Uh-huh. And in our training, even, you know, it's not that, again, it becomes about us and our own lived experiences and story. And you know, we want to have a measure, obviously, of good boundaries and professionalism, right? But I think this generation, this moment of time, is calling for truth telling. It's calling for risk taking. It's calling for us, you know. And I think when we understand again the function of the brain, of the biopsychosocial factors in mental health, we understand that it's less of what we used to call, like, you know, the mental health condition in a stigmatized way. It's more of a human condition. They were up against these forces in society that are really inhumane, even like overwork or expectations of today, of perfectionism and hyper performance. And we see it reflected in the burnout rates and the global mental health crisis. That people are just struggling. You know, I feel like we even like stigmatize leisure. You know, it's like we are just expected to perform like robots and machines and then never cry uncle. Yeah. And I think that, again, when people come forth, it's very powerful to say, you know, even in these positions where it seems like I have so-called success or I have resources, these are the truths of my story. And I really believe that's, you know, when we form that level of solidarity as human beings, it's very healing. It's very healing. And, you know, I've taken some of those risks in my public work.
How so?
Well, I feel like it started, you know, like in my writing, you know, my first books, you know, there were like what I would call maybe more like micro disclosures, you know, so nothing too play by playish or like too revealing, so to speak. And then, you know, I've been working now in higher ed for 12 years. And as I've just increasingly had more leadership opportunity and more of a public platform, I just felt like, and as someone who, again, is dead against mental health stigma, who wants to see prevention, access, integration, have the right kinds of allocation for mental health. And I believe, again, that no one who suffers with a lived experience of mental health should be stigmatized. Here I was, you know, kind of increasing my leadership roles, my visibility. And I realized, like, you know, sometimes I was a little more, you know, too much about my research and, you know, I could like put it into very professional terms. And I don't feel like I was adding enough color and texture to my own story. And so I think like the first, like my biggest moment was at the university where I teach. I had like a book talk scheduled and it was on a Monday, snowy Monday in New England. And like, you know, at first, like no one was coming into the room. So I'm thinking like, no one's going to turn out. It's a snowy Monday. It's just me and the pizza guy. And then slowly but surely, it was a full house. It was standing room only. people started pouring in right at the top of the hour. And it was packed with my students who inspire me with their stories of resilience. And then also my amazing colleagues, my bosses, like the pizza guy.
Those people show up too. Yeah.
Everyone was there. So it just moved me. The energy in the room moved me. And I said, you know, to myself, I'm going to kind of go off script, forget the PowerPoint. I'm going to really speak from the heart and give a little bit more behind the scenes of how my brain works. And I like really let a lot out. And I have to tell you, Dave, at the end of it all, I was like a little bit worried, you know, I was worried, like, you know, the classic, like, am I going to get in trouble? Are they going to think different of me? Are they going to start watching me? I wasn't sure what was going to happen. And I almost wanted to like drive home and not go back to my office after.
Well, yeah, sometimes when we do overshare or think that we overshare, yeah, we can have quite a bit of anxiety about that. Yeah.
And I was definitely stewing in that on my walk back to the office. But then I was greeted by, thank you so much for saying that. That's exactly how I felt. I was afraid to say that. And I will tell you, I think, you know, that moment for me was a defining moment because it invited a different level of community for me in my life with my colleagues. And then, you know, I went on to tell the story in my TEDx talk, and a lot of people saw that. And I think just increasingly in all my public work, I'm just calling out the insidiousness of, like, you know, hiding in the shadows or pretending we're fine. Yeah. Or I think also just to help illuminate the paradoxical nature for anyone that struggles with mental health issues, that on one hand, we can be very accomplished and bright and we can be focused and doing well. And then the next hot second, we can feel like we're a mess or we're struggling or we're unraveling. And that vacillates sometimes from day to day. Sometimes, you know, seasons of our lives just have, again, more excruciating factors to contend with. So I think just bringing that solidarity, that shared experience, those risks that I've taken have been very healing to me. I think especially because I know that they've been healing to people that I've had influence with. And that means so much to me. That's really the whole purpose of why I'm here. It's a real part of my value set, to eradicate stigma. So I feel like I could just be like, here's my research, here's my data points, read this article. I really wanted to, you know, kind of walk the talk.
Right. Well, something that I noticed and haven't discussed with you is that there was a name change between your first book and your second book. And so I'm suspecting that you went through a divorce.
I have, yeah. And that's, you know, it's been a tough few years for me, really. And I think the difficulties I've experienced on the personal level, and, you know, I would even call some of the circumstances I've been through traumatic, that it's really, I think, just while it's been difficult, it's also just, I think, reminded me again of how do I root myself in deep self-care practices. How do I situate myself in the world? How do I express myself in the world? It brings you back to the table of, you know, what are your values and what relationships do you need to nurture and nourish? And I think for myself, as, you know, I call myself a recovering perfectionist, as a person to really practice self-compassion through these tumultuous moments of life that many of us go through, but where you can carry a lot of shame or guilt or just trauma symptoms even. And so I feel like everything is, you know, a teachable moment for us. We learn so much through our challenges, but I think I feel grateful for many of the challenges I've experienced because it has, I think, deepened my own empathy. I think, you know, when we go through something personally, it really connects us with each other because there's so many parallels in what, you know, these rites of passages or challenges that we face. And I think that can end up serving as a deep source of bonding and human connection.
Yeah. We had a little email exchange back and forth. And one of the things that you mentioned was taking a look at the pandemic through the lens of trauma-informed therapy. And what is it that you can derive from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is actually one of the most important things we consider now and for a long time. And I think that our culture can be very on the side of motivational pressure or what we might call a return to so-called normal. And I resist those framings because, you know, there was no such thing as normal to begin with. And life is has never been normal. Again, when we look at systemic issues, you know, none of that is normal. And then when we look at our own lives and our own variables and variances and what we deal with. So I think that I worry that sometimes people just like, okay, let's return back. Let's go back to the way we were overworking and, you know, just running from here to there. And when I encourage a trauma-informed lens, I want us all to remember that these circumstances that we're enduring and have endured have certainly been excruciating. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to be very mindful about what we do on the daily that is within our locus of control. What are the things that we can leverage that science shows are protective towards our well-being? Even if we don't feel like it's like the worst day in the world and we're suffering immensely, but having those rituals and routines and things that we do so we can stay well and do well in the world are really vital. And I think what I've been noticing, and I'm sure you've seen this too, Dave, is like people with this anniversary coming up, I think it was very provocative and triggering. I think that there's an element still when we think from a trauma-informed lens of shock still, even though it's been, you know, like we talked about time being kind of weird, it still, I think, can be an element of surrealness. And then I think the thing is, as we now, some of us are going back into work environments or anticipating that, I think it's interesting. We've been like pining to get back to these things, right, that we've missed, but they're going to be very different than they were before. And I think what I've been hearing from a lot of people is that it's sobering, you know, it's kind of just, you know, because you're thinking this is going to be great. And then, you know, it kind of makes the reality of what we've been going through sink in deeper. So
you might have romanticized the way it was. Yeah,
exactly. Romanticize it or just romanticize the return even like. So yeah. this is going to be it. And I think when we take a trauma-informed lens, it's just one, again, of allowing ourselves time and doing the kinds of things that can help us heal from trauma and grief, right? Yeah. And those, I think those are things that sometimes people, they think resilience is like you're born with it or you're not. And I don't think we often teach resilience as an active process. We can be really strategic about.
Yeah. Let me jump in here to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp, the world's premier online therapy service. You know, I interview a lot of therapists, and during this pandemic, most are doing online therapy and report it's extremely effective. Many are saying they'll stick with online even after the pandemic is over. If you need help, BetterHelp is the premier service for online counseling and therapy. Within 48 hours, BetterHelp can match you up with a licensed professional therapist regardless of where in the world you are. And they are committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, even making it easy and free to change counselors if needed. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. Beyond that, financial aid is available. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. For example, here's one that was posted on April 5th, and the review is written by BetterHelp user MA after counseling with Caitlin Whitebread for 8 months on issues concerning depression, stress, anxiety, relationship issues, family conflicts, trauma and abuse, eating disorders, sleeping disorders, parenting issues, self-esteem, career difficulties, bipolar disorder, coping with life changes, compassion fatigue, and ADHD. And this user writes, "I genuinely love Caitlin so much. We connect so well, and she's really good at calming me down and making me think things through more. Visit betterhelp.com/SHRINK. That's betterhelp.com/shrink. Now here's the special offer for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. You'll get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/shrink. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Shrink Wrap Radio listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/shrink. Now, back to the interview. What's your stance toward the people who, the quotes, young people, who are acting like COVID isn't real, you know, and getting together for spring break and all the stuff that we see on the news of large gatherings and denial. I vacillate between judgment and trying to find some degree of compassion of remembering what it was like to be that age. The judgment comes off pretty quickly, though. How do you deal with this complex reality that we're seeing?
I think it's one of the most difficult things for us to all grapple with, given the kind of brouhaha of disinformation, misinformation. Yeah. We're just seeing, like, you know, that's, I think a lot of people, myself included, have been talking about, you know, just that layer of the pandemic being so problematic. And I think at the end of the day, you know, I used to think like artificial intelligence or technology, one of the main issues you think of, you know, is like it's going to take people's jobs. But I think that our true concern right now is that it's really, you know, disrupting critical thinking skills. We're getting so much information so quickly, and it's very persuasive. You know, anyone that has like a good camera angle and like the right team, I mean, we can make very short, very succinct, compelling information. And that's, yeah, I think, really become erosive to people's capacity to process. Plus, I mean, none of us want to, you know, our mind wants to believe what's convenient to believe. So it's a hard horse pill to swallow, you know, like not seeing friends and for a long time, you know. Yeah. And so I think that could be disrupting, you know, decision making and critical thinking. And I think just to your question around, how do you avoid extremes of judgment or, you know, just, I think it's a matter of recognizing that these forces really have a stranglehold on us. And I think what we can do if we want to, you know, be positive contributors in society is just keep in our own ways doing the work of trying to discern information, not make, you know, fear-based decisions or quick decisions, but take the time to try to find trusted sources. And then I think also move from the me to the we, you know, like, you know, a lot of my research really focuses on collective efficacy and the idea that when one of us do well, we all do well. When one of us hurt, we all hurt. And I think that aspect in our culture is really important, you know, that we don't just look out for ourselves or think about our own interests, but we think about the interest of one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's hard not to judge when we see behavior that feels very like disregarding of the we, or when it feels like it could be putting people at risk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that some of it we can try to be positive influences with, and sometimes we can't control behavior, but I think we can control our own ways of showing up in the world with a values-based intentionality that really supports the collective good. Yeah. But it's difficult. And then I think, again, of course, the news stories are going to be like these quick bites, right? Of like, look, you know, and it's not showing all the students who don't engage in that behavior,
right,
or across the generations. It's like everyone's taking it in different ways. And so I think the news and the social media, I mean, they have a lot of, they're making a lot of money off of our polarization and our fighting and yeah, captivating our attention with these like really frustrating stories.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to watch out for that.
Yeah. That's a good point, that they always go to the hot spots, you know, to what's broken, what's wrong, and they make money by scaring us, really.
fear works. It's a huge vice, and they know how to work every angle of it.
Yeah.
It's like a whack-a-mole game. If you weren't afraid about this, you know, you feel like you like deal with one fear, the next one pops up.
Right.
It's a nonstop thing. And I think that piece is one that it concerns me gravely. And I think we all really have to see the addictive nature of technology in the news cycle, and then really look at where do we get our sources, and how are we spending our time in ways that are proven to help sustain us through challenges.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen a study come out yet that says being tethered to your phone 6 or 7 hours a day is good for you. I haven't seen a study like that yet.
No, but we've seen a lot suggesting that it's not good for you. You know, it's like we don't need a lot of evidence on that. It's really apparent in so many ways.
Mm.
So what have you, let's talk about self-care strategies and what are some of the ones that you're trying? What do you see going on with other people in terms of self-care?
Well, I think, Dave, one of the things, again, that's encouraged me, you know, I feel like I've always been a self-care ambassador or evangelist, you know, to really see, you know, all those years of being a psychotherapist, you would see that so many people were so overworked, just hadn't had yet that skill training around self-care. So they thought it would be selfish to do self-care, or maybe even with marketers pitching self-care as like, you know, salt baths and chocolate cake and mani-pedis. I think a lot of people have distorted views of self-care as just being like self-indulgence. But science really shows us that self-care that's evidence-based has a really high impact on our well-being. So some of the main ones include sleep, you know, sleep being absolutely one of the most critical aspects of our well-being, of our regulation, of our just our overall functioning well-being. We also understand nutrition and hydration, exercise and movement, time in nature, again, time off the screen. All of those things are seen as really protective. And I know a lot of people, again, that are like maneuvering at home with family members and kids and teaching and the whole online. I mean, it's just the enormity of it is not to be oversimplified. And it's almost, you know, I know a lot of people have had reports of sleep disruptions and just, again, technology overload. And so I think, again, it goes back to looking at what is within our locus of control. And I really think, you know, micro breaks, you know, rituals that we have in our day, little mini, you know, small chunks of time, looking at our day and seeing, you know, what's possible. So could it be, for example, shifting a meeting from sitting to walking, or could it be, you know, really trying to, you know, like shift some eating behavior, like maybe like one meal a day you focus on shifting it from less healthy to healthier? Or could it be an extra 15 minutes of night of sleep, or an extra 10, you know, 5,000 steps a day or 2,000 steps a day? So I think all those pieces serve as a deep foundation for our well-being. But what I'll also say is, I think the pandemic has called upon us to become more creative in our self-care, because a lot of people say, myself included, the things we went to before that seem pretty nourishing and sustaining aren't working, and we kind of need to up the ante again. And so I've made some kind of neat discoveries this past year through my work and in my own personal experiment, you know, to try to be more creative in self-care and kind of like making it more expansive in order to stay well.
Yeah. What's a concrete example of that in your own life? Something that used to work for you, but then you're finding like it wasn't really powerful enough during this time.
Well, I think like a lot of people, my sleep cycle can sometimes be disrupted through everything. So I've had different moments where before I was pretty regulated with it, and then sometimes I'd be waking up with anxiety or just kind of struggling with that. So that's something like an example. Or I'm certainly, I'd call myself an ambivert, but I'm very much a people person, you know, so even though you know, I don't mind being alone and I need solitude to regroup. I think this whole thing of, you know, connecting with people has been really hard. And so just looking at like, okay, what is possible? So there's been a few friends I've been able to do like safe walks with. Now I'm actually, I've been fully vaccinated for almost like 6 weeks now.
Me too.
So it's allowed for greater flexibility now, but throughout things, you know, again, you had to be innovative and say, okay, this isn't possible. And a lot of us were saying at first when they said, you know, social distancing, we're like, no, no, call it distancing, but we can still try to be creative on how we stay socially connected because that's ever so important. So those are just like a couple of examples, but I feel like there's like a, probably like a bigger discovery that I've made that I really believe in. And I'm like into the research around it, but I've really been trying to live it out in my life as well.
Yeah. One of the things that you've been doing that you told me about and that I was able to check out mm-hmm. is you've been doing online Zooms with folks that you call cracking up.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell us about that. Yeah. What was the inspiration for it? How's it going? What are the mechanics of it?
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's inspired by the pandemic. I mean, this for me, I will say, so the show is called Cracking Up, where therapy meets comedy. And, you know, Dave, you know, I travel around the world again, you know, giving talks on mental health. And I've always used humor in my model, you know, because it's heavy topics. You know, I talk again about systemic isms and disparities and the mental health crisis. And, you know, from the work, right, it's heavy, it's intense. There's a lot of trauma at hand. And so I've always, you know, infused humor as a way to kind of offset that and as a way for us to cope and to connect with each other. And early in the pandemic, it was just, you know, like, again, like, I think it's like day after day, you're just in a state of shock over what's happening sociopolitically and health, public health wise. And I think it just like, it almost feels in those moments irreverent. Like, how could you even find anything that's funny? Or how could you, you know, be playful or what I might call invoke your childhood spirit? You know, it just feels almost counterintuitive. But I just saw that this is really, we see it in the resilience research, how important humor is a protective factor. So what, and I don't know about you, but I know, you know, your legacy as an academic and as a clinician, right? And I'm sort of this weird mix, like where I get so intense about everything and I'm so serious and I'm so committed to the cause. And then I'm definitely like very active and silly. So I think I just started to lean into that about myself. And like, you know, I'm finishing my third book right now. It's another nonfiction. It's intense. And I'm like, you know what? I could also just start writing comedy. And that's what I did. I just started to write comedy and I started to do like these creative poems and essays. And I just let myself, you know, kind of take the hands off the handlebars.
Yeah.
And let that flow. And I found it to be like amongst the most important things for me through all this turmoil. Because again, my schedule's high octane. Since we last spoke, I'm still the lead faculty for behavior science at Northeastern, but I'm also a faculty in residence. I live on campus. So again, I'm in the thick of this mental health crisis of helping, and I'm holding the space for a lot of hard things right now. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it's not to say I don't take all that very seriously, but this world I've created of humor and fun and comedy, it's been probably the thing that has helped me stay sane. And I say in the show, I'm like, if we're not cracking up, we're going to crack up, or if we can't laugh, we're going to cry.
Yeah.
So I think it's really, you know, my goal for the show, I'm lucky, like I consider you a dear friend. So many of my friends are practitioners and clinicians and they do this work. So it's been so fun because they've jumped into the show. So there's literally like a psychiatrist and two psychotherapists. We also had an improv comedian on the show.
Good.
So like we're tackling these kinds of like heavy things, but we're doing it with levity. You know, we're having fun.
Yeah.
And there's a playful spirit. And I think we're also trying to, I think humor is actually one of the most brilliant modalities in performing arts. And I wrote an article about, you know, can humor save the day? And I think it really is brilliant because it helps, call the whistle, you know, blow the whistle on society for the BS that's there. So humor has a way of being able to poke at things and to be able to educate us and help us to think, you know, about things. So I think it's, there's a lot to humor. And I've always, you know, if you ask my family of origin, like, she's always been hyperactive and silly and kind of like an entertainer. And I think in my own process, being a first generation student, coming into the institution 12 years ago, I was a little bit intimidated. And I was like, not that I just never like cracked a smile, but I was kind of very serious. And I think over time, even starting with me telling my mental health story, I've loosened up and I've just been able to really be more of my full self, that I can be, because that's the other thing. Research shows that when women, professional women use humor, it's usually frowned upon. And when men do it, they typically are seen as like it's more of a favorable thing. And then obviously with cancel culture and humor sometimes can go the wrong way. Like people could use humor in a way to really like, you know, be mean against a group or, you know, and then it's like, well, I was joking. So there's a lot of that element too. So I think humor can also be nuanced and tricky. And that's something, you know, I'm thinking a lot about as I take this step to almost split my model and make it so more people can access these deeper underlying messages around it's okay not to be okay. No one has to be perfect. That our mental health is the most important thing. And, you know, just to, again, be able to look at ourselves with more self-compassion. I think humor is one of the greatest pathways towards that.
Yeah. Did you ever want to be a stand-up comedian?
Yes. Yes, I did. So that's the other thing. I'd given it a lot of thought in my early 20s. And, you know, I had my children and life was busy getting degrees and just all the things. So I kind of feel like I'm coming back to some of those things now that my son and daughter are raised. And so the funny thing is I haven't actually like performed formal stand-up comedy, but now that things are opening up, that's my next. Last year was actually like had a whole list of the open mics and so forth, and I was going to begin that. So as soon as it's safe for me to do that, I'm going to start to perform.
Wow.
And it's not because I'm not convinced that my next path in life is to be a stand-up comedian per se. I actually have a few different ideas about where I want to see Cracking Up go, but I think it's just, it's like, again, one of those things. I don't have to have a goal with it. I can just have fun. And for anyone out there that's like, everything has to be like, you know, all to an end. Like, I can get like that. Like, what if I just go do a bunch of it and it doesn't mean then I have to like be a full stand-up comedian? And maybe I would do that, or, you know, but I think it's great skill development. And the other thing is, I've done some improv classes, and I wouldn't want to be an improv performer. But I look at my life every day as if it's an improv skit. And improv skills are wonderful in terms of helping us to be agile and adaptable. You know, you think something's going to go one way, the next thing you know, there's some kind of disaster at hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in our relationships, a big concept in improv comedy is the yes and way of interacting.
Yes.
So, you know, like just building off people, building off strengths and building off possibility and innovation. And then, you know, just being playful and high energy and all those skills that come there, I think, are also really great lessons for us and moments that feel not funny at all and that feel super heavy, you know?
Yeah. I have been in a couple of improv, maybe weekends, day long workshops or weekend workshops. I always enjoyed those mightily. And I definitely have had fantasies of the stand-up, but I find it totally terrifying, just one of the most terrifying things that I could imagine ever doing. So, you know, the fact that you have the courage to cuddle up to this thing is really impressive.
I'll be sweating bullets. I will. I know I will.
Yeah. But, you know, I could, on watching what you were doing on the Crack Up show that I went on, was you just had a lot of energy, you know, and you're talking fast and you're just riffing and, you know, in interaction with the other people there and talking, and you were pulling it off. You know, I was a little nervous to tune in, a little scared for you, you know, saying, oh my God, what's she getting herself into here?
I tried to definitely, you know, again, take a very intentional approach, because that's the other thing too, is that, you know, I have a lot of influence in the roles I have. And I think one thing I'm just, again, trying to model for those I serve and those that take part in this is to see that, again, there's a lot of sides to all of us. And I think performing arts in general, whether through music or other modalities, it's all super therapeutic. And I think, you know, it's important for us to take those kinds of risks in our life, even if, I mean, it's interesting, you know, you as, again, such an accomplished person, as a wonderful speaker, even still feeling like that would be a terrifying thing, right?
Oh,
and I
yeah.
think I've heard
yeah.
a lot of people say even just public speaking is terrifying.
Right.
I mean, I think that it's there's a healthiness to being provoked. And I think, again, we all have different things we're called to do and ways of expressing ourselves. But if we really have that calling, I think it's worth listening to. And I think for myself, sometimes I'll sit there and say, oh no, like, you know, cause in the first three shows, I've disclosed a lot of things, you know, I'm very self-depreciating. I've disclosed, cause I don't know that everyone publicly knew like my sexual orientation or even just like, I would have never like in
I
the
didn't.
Last show.
I didn't until I watched the show.
You didn't know, right? And then the other thing is a lot of people wouldn't have known like, oh, you had to go on a dating app, you know? And like, those are things that I would probably like, if you asked me a year or two, I wouldn't tell anybody that this was not necessarily my orientation, but more just admitting that. And then even in the last show, we were talking about the beauty industry, for example, and I was really talking about the dissonance I experience as a person who like never wants to be vain, or I don't like how, you know, people can be objectified because of their appearance. So my woman empowerment side is like, against these things in the beauty industry and just the messages that we receive. And then yet at the same time, I'm grappling with my own aging process and wanting to like look as good as I feel. And, you know, just dabbling, like I talked about how I did Botox and like, you know, and I kind of like, again, do it in a playful way, but I'm not trying to say in the show someone should do it or they shouldn't. I think through humor, we can just illustrate like all these paradoxical things. Like, we have these certain beliefs and then they get challenged through the perils of life. And I mean, if you think about it, as a therapist by training, you know, a lot of your job is to hold space and to try to help make people feel better. Comedy is very similar. Comedy, you're trying to help people look at things in a more constructive way and to feel better. So I feel like therapists and comedians have more in common than we think.
Yeah. You know what I'm having a fantasy for you is as a monologue. You know, I was trying to think, well, where has therapy most crisscrossed with comedy, with like stand-up comedy? Has there been a therapist stand-up comedian? There probably has been. Nobody comes to mind right away, but I've seen monologues that really captured that. You know, they can be funny in parts, but then also bring in the pain and the drama and all of that. And some people have really pulled that off wonderfully well in a really good, big way. My own, you know, when I was teaching, I haven't thought of, you know, sitting down and trying to write something comedic. That's a very thought-provoking thing for me to hear you say that. But when I was teaching, I could be really funny. And I liked that. I liked kind of showing off that way. I liked the laughter. And but it was had to be interactive. I couldn't just walk in cold someplace and be funny. but people would ask me, you know, oh, you know, are you thinking about doing stand-up or something like that? So that was very gratifying. But
yeah,
and I used to do market research, and in my market research, I was traveling all around the country, and I realized, well, I could burn out, you know, traveling and staying in hotels at first is really exciting, but I realized I could burn out on this really fast. I want to make sure that every time I go to do that work in a city, that I do something to have a good time. And for me, what that was going to comedy clubs. So,
nice.
Yeah, so I got to go to, you know, the comedy clubs in New York and Chicago and other cities, and always enjoyed that.
That's terrific. It is, and I think,
we've
again,
gotten
like
off on comedy here. What about the pandemic?
Well, I think I think that's the thing. And I mean, if you think about like Trevor Noah, or you like even Sarah Cooper, she was doing a lot of impersonations, and just the different comedic material that emerged through last year and now. I think it really, you know, when again there's such gravity at hand, and like again, it feels like there's just nothing to laugh at or to look forward to. Those comedians, I think, and, you know, think of different shows like Schitt's Creek has been one that's been really, really popular. And just again, like such great messages within in these shows, but it just gives us some joy. And I think when we look at it again from a brain science perspective, you know, those elements of being able to toggle away from the stress and into these moments of joy and fun and playfulness, how important that is. So,
yeah.
I love talking about it. Thank you. Like, I love your vision for me. And I did write a monologue about that. I just haven't performed it yet. So I'll have to keep you posted how that emerges.
Do that.
But I think, I think after doing, you know, I've served as a therapist for over 20 years. So it's like you there's a lot of stories, and you do have a really good eye into the human mind and the human perspective. And so, of course, I wouldn't get up and ever share like people's literal stories or that kind of thing. But I think it's a great teacher.
Yeah.
And then just in my own, you know, personality, everything, it's like I've just learned to, like, again, you can teach through humor. I think that's another like big motivation for me, is that's how we learn. Research shows we learn when we feel safe, when we feel relaxed, that laughter, humor can actually be really a big catalyst for learning. And I know like my students even, it's not that my classroom is a comedy platform, but I think they appreciate that authentic spirit, and that, you know, again, like we can kind of laugh at life together and, you know, work in a particular way and have a certain climate in the classroom. I think that creativity is well received by my students too.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. So what's this third book that you're working on? Can you share anything about that?
I can. I'm so thankful for my partnership with Sounds True. They are just like amazing in the space of just the fusions of psychology and spirituality and, you know, just elevating the human condition. And so the title is like, I don't think it's public yet, but it's going to come out next year. And it's really about risk-taking and how that leads to resilience. So as you can imagine, some of this comedy discussion is in the book. But it really focuses on, you know, how risk is often pitched as, you know, or bravery is pitched as something that, like, can, you know, risk is, like, going to lead to disaster. So people sometimes think of, like, you know, gambling or other, like, high-risk behavior. And I think we're taught to live in a space of fear around who we are or what are people going to think about us. This book really, I think, is going to help people look at the kinds of risks that we can architect. You know, we can architect our own risk choices. And sometimes that might be showing up as our real selves, disclosing things about ourselves, or, you know, standing up against social issues. And looking for like our shared humanity. And so I really tackle a lot of pieces around how society is really eroding our well-being, whether we look at, you know, if we're constructing our identity, for example, on how many likes are on our feed, or, you know, just all those kinds of pressures of today, that we're looking at it as, let's architect our own experiences and take chances where they're worth taking to get to that place where we're leading a values-driven life and a life that's really the one that we're meant to live, not the one that everyone says we should live to be so-called successful.
But you mentioned a partnership with Sounds True, and Sounds mm-hmm. True rings a bell, but tell me about that. What is that partnership?
I mean, they're just awesome. I mean, they've published Eckhart Tolle and Brené Brown and Tara Brach and Jeff Kornfield. So they just like, they just are very, I think the thing I love is just, again, how I feel sometimes science and spirituality feel like they're at odds. And I think they really appreciate kind of like looking at the intersections around different perspectives and how they can be fused together. So they're just great thought leaders in the space and just have put out so many, you know, phenomenal authors and thought leaders. And so I just really appreciate, like, let's put it this way. They get my weirdness. They like my weirdness.
Yeah.
Like, this is where it can be tricky, because I fuse, you know, story, humor, science, psychology, spirituality, social issues. So there's like a lot of things in it, and then, you know, like weaving it together, but they get it. And I think that means a lot, because I don't want to feel like I have to like truncate different parts of myself, you know, to sell a book, or, you know, to kind of have like an oversimplified formula for well-being.
Yeah.
So I think this is really about meeting the reader where they're at in terms of architecting a life that is really true to one's essence, and one that allows you adventure and fun and, you know, just interesting experiences. And I think even like relationship wise, one thing I worry about is people are talking about loneliness as the new smoking, as the health risk of today. And that's a real concern. And I think, again, in a world that's transient, in a world where non-traditional relationship structures are becoming traditional, in a world where, like, you know, families move all, like, it's just, there's not necessarily like that old way of people having, you know, constant community. When people move from a different country, for example, and they study, you know, it's like you're reforming your whole, you know, network. And I think a lot of finding that element of loneliness, or even like people who are nonconformists, and they feel like you might have a lot of people around, but no one really understands me. And I think that element of loneliness is something, you know, I'm really doing a lot of writing about and thinking about how do we reimagine, you know, connection, and know that none of us are alone, and that we can keep building relationships across our lifespan. Because you know this, and I know this, like, you know, life changes, people move, people come and go, people flake, we flake, like, you know, there's always constant flux, there's death, there's divorce, there's, you know, there's just always change. The people you were once close to, something goes wrong, or it's just part of life cycle, things permanent. And so I think just even being able to put ourselves out there, like you said, you'd be terrified to do stand-up comedy. Think of all the things we're terrified to do. Like even in the online dating show, we were talking about that. Like, I didn't want to get on the dating app, but it was like, I was either going to get on the dating apps and try to find some interesting people to connect with, or like be a case study for loneliness.
Yeah.
You know? Right. So the risk was worth taking, you know, and it didn't mean everything's perfect and every single, you know, like, it wasn't, that's, life isn't like that. We romanticize these things. It's not like that. But if you have that sense of adventure and spirit of risk, and, you know, you take good measure to be careful, obviously, there's risks that are worth taking. And I think you've seen in my TEDx talk, it's called The Risk You Must Take, which is showing up as the real you, that being real is the power skill of the century. So if we can be our full selves, if we can say, yep, I'm a professional, I have this knowledge set, I could share my data with you, and I can tell you all of my successes. And then I can also tell you, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm scared 95% of the time. This is all true. Like, it's all true all at once. And I think when we can just embrace those sides of our narratives, it allows for greater self-compassion, but also shared connection and humanity and solidarity.
That's a great wrap-up statement. So I think we're going to end it here. And Kristen, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's always a delight, Dave. Take great care and always. Thank you.
I always like speaking with Dr. Kristen Lee. Like me going by the moniker Dr. Dave, in her public appearances, she's Dr. Chris. She is so full of energy and good science-based ideas. Going into the interview, I didn't realize we'd be focusing as much as we did on the importance of humor in getting through the pandemic. It turned out that a strong sense of humor has been a key aspect of both of our personalities. A frequent piece of feedback from many Shrink Wrap Radio listeners over the years is that one of the things they value has been my own sense of humor. I'm hoping that's still true. I'm really impressed by Dr. Chris taking her own humor seriously enough as to have written out some comedy sketches. I think that takes real courage and a leap of faith. And then there are the sessions she's been doing on Zoom that she's named Cracking Up, in which she'll pick a topic for each session and just start improvising and engaging the other people on the call in a lighthearted way. The session I lurked on was about the dating scene and some of her own experiences with an online dating service. She would read out a variety of profiles people had posted in their attempts to attract interesting dates. It really raised difficult questions that we all have struggled with at some point about self-presentation, how much to disclose, to be earnest or light. She had a couple of other female therapists on the call who are friends of hers to lightly share experience, past frustrations, successes, and disasters. After our interview was over, Dr. Chris let me know she's even had a nibble of interest from Hollywood about possibilities for this format. Our focus for the interview was to present ideas for enhancing resilience during the pandemic, given that we are more or less at the one-year mark here in the U.S. Those of us who have taken seriously the dangers presented by COVID have been in physical isolation for a whole year. It's hard to believe. It's a bit like being under house arrest. Some of us have been alone. Others have served their time in family or friend pods. For some, those small social groups have provided comfort and security. For others, it's meant a kind of imprisonment with inmates who are driving you crazy. So Dr. Chris and I agree that you need to hunker down and do a bit of self-examination along with a healthy dose of self-compassion and self-acceptance. I keep coming back to the notion or insight that we're all survivors. The very fact that we are alive in this time and place is evidence of some very viable genetics and ancestry with social skills good enough to get us here. Each one of us stands on an ancestral tree, roots of which go way back not only in time, but also to other countries, climes, and continents. All those folks who died in wars, plagues, starvations, and so on, well, they got pruned from the tree. We are of those who survived. So by all means, take that in. You are a survivor. Remind yourself of that fundamental fact. It's something to cling to. By the same token, celebrate the miracle that you're alive. What a gift. We know our brains have an unfortunate tendency to go toward the depressive end of the scale. Don't get stuck in that monkey mind. Bring yourself into the present. And as Dr. Chris pointed out, avoid those outside media influences that tend to bring you down. Don't be a news junkie. The world will continue on its way without you minding it every moment. As you look back on your life, what's brought you joy? What made your heart sing? What made you laugh? You don't have to be happy, happy all the time. Get in touch with the bittersweet sense of life as well. What puts you in touch with your own depths? Be physically isolated if need be, but don't be socially isolated. We all need support and comfort of others, and we all need to be givers, not just receivers. Dr. Chris urges that you don't need to burden yourself with some huge plan of self-reformation. Baby steps, baby. What's one small adjustment you could make that would move you towards your goal? Well, these are some of my own thoughts stimulated by this session with Dr. Chris. She has an April 11, 2020 online article on psychologytoday.com. It's titled, How We Find Resilience During Impossible Times. Hint, it's not sucking it up or going on self-improvement benders, close quote. Now here's a quote that sums up what I've just been saying quite well. Quote, work to stay in the now. Anyone who has a fear of heights has been told, don't look down, to avoid that flooding of panic and fear. Similarly, if we are constantly focused on the fear of falling sick or spiraling downwards, we won't be able to focus on what the present moment offers. Resilience involves developing a now mindset, one that works to do your best in the moment and creates the space for grieving, coping, connection, creativity, and gratitude. These are all evidence-based means of sustaining us in the long run. Close quote. Thank you, Dr. Kristen Lee.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Charles Cogshill calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Longtime listener and fan. Just want to send out a thank you for the incredible service you provide to growing clinical excellence and to the general public, and want to highly recommend others like myself that have benefited from your wonderful informative interviews to stop what they're doing right now and go ahead and make that contribution, that pledge to you for, again, the excellent work that you do. Wishing you the best and hope to donate many, many times more. Thanks and good luck.
Thank you, Charles Cogshill in St. Louis, Missouri. I truly appreciate your support, especially at this time. Well, somebody who did stop to become an ongoing donor is Miko Karahulati. Thank you so much, Miko, and your name has been added to the honor roll on our site. Thanks so much to today's return guest, Dr. Kristen Lee, for helping us to think through our resilience strategies during this pandemic. Next week's return guest will be Jungian analyst Lisa Marciano, who will be talking about her new book, Motherhood, Facing and Finding Yourself. She's also a podcaster at This Jungian Life. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio, coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast. He's got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
You've been shrink wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.